Macmillan Audio presents The Revenant by Michael Punk. Read for you by Holter Graham. Avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, Vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord. Romans 12:18-20. September 1st, 1823. They were abandoning him. The wounded man knew it when he looked at the boy, who looked down, then away, unwilling to hold his gaze. For days the boy had argued with the man in the wolfskin hat. Had it really been days? The wounded man had battled his fever and pain, never certain whether conversations he heard were real or merely byproducts of the delirious wanderings in his mind. He looked up at the soaring rock formation above the clearing. A lone twisted pine had managed somehow to grow from the sheer face of the stone. He had stared at it many times, yet it had never appeared to him as it did at that moment, when its perpendicular lines seemed clearly to form a cross. He accepted for the first time that he would die there in that clearing by the spring. The wounded man felt an odd detachment from the scene in which he played the central role. He wondered briefly what he would do in their position. If they stayed and the war party came up the creek, all of them would die. Would I die for them, if they were certain to die anyway? You sure they're coming up the creek? The boy's voice cracked as he said it. He could affect a tenor most of the time, but his tone still broke at moments he could not control. The man in the wolfskin stooped hurriedly by the small meat rack near the fire, stuffing strips of partially dried venison into his parfleche. You wanna stay and find out? The wounded man tried to speak. He felt again the piercing pain in his throat. Sound came forth, but he could not shape it into the one word he sought to articulate. The man in the wolfskin ignored the sound as he continued to gather his few belongings, but the boy turned. He's trying to say something. The boy dropped on one knee next to the wounded man. Unable to speak, the man raised his working arm and pointed. He wants his rifle, said the boy. He wants us to set him up with his rifle. The man in the wolfskin covered the ground between them in quick, measured steps. He kicked the boy hard, square in the back. Move, goddamn you! He strode quickly from the boy to the wounded man who lay next to the meager pile of his possessions. A possible's bag, a knife in a beaded scabbard, a hatchet, a rifle, and a powder horn. As the wounded man watched helplessly, the man in the wolfskin stooped to pick up the possible's bag. He dug inside for the flint and steel, dropping them into the pocket on the front of his leather tunic. He grabbed the powder horn and slung it over his shoulder. The hatchet he tucked under his broad leather belt. What are you doing? Asked the boy. The man stooped again, picked up the knife, and tossed it to the boy. Take that. The boy caught it, staring in horror at the scabbard in his hand. Only the rifle remained. The man in the wolfskin picked it up, checking quickly to ensure it was charged. Sorry, old glass. You ain't got much more use for any of this. The boy appeared stunned. We can't leave him without his kit. The man in the wolfskin looked up briefly, then disappeared into the woods. The wounded man stared up at the boy, who stood there for a long moment with the knife. His knife. Finally, the boy raised his eyes. At first, it appeared that he might say something. Instead, he spun around and fled into the pines. The wounded man stared at the gap in the trees where they had disappeared. His rage was complete, consuming him as fire envelops the needles of a pine. He wanted nothing in the world except to place his hands around their necks and choke the life from them. Instinctively, he started to yell out, forgetting again that his throat produced no words, only pain. He raised himself on his left elbow. He could bend his right arm slightly, but it would support no weight. The movement sent agonizing bolts through his neck and back. He felt the strain of his skin against the crude sutures. He looked down at his leg, where the bloody remnants of an old shirt were tightly wrapped. He could not flex his thigh to make the leg work. Marshaling his strength, he rolled heavily to his stomach. He felt the snap of a suture breaking and the warm wetness of new blood on his back. The pain diluted to nothing against the tide of his rage. Hugh Glass began to crawl. Part 1. 1. August 21st, 1823.
"My keelboat from St. Louis is due here any day, Monsieur Ashley,"
the portly Frenchman explained it again in his patient but insistent tone.
"I gladly sell the Rocky Mountain Fur Company the entire contents of the boat, but I can't sell you what I don't have."
William H. Ashley slammed his tin cup on the crude slats of the table. The carefully groomed gray of his beard did not conceal the tight clench of his jaw. For its part, the clenched jaw seemed unlikely to contain another outburst, as Ashley found himself confronting again the one thing he despised above all else. Waiting. The Frenchman, with the unlikely name of Kiowa Brazeau, watched Ashley with growing trepidation. Ashley's presence at Kiowa's remote trading post presented a rare opportunity, and Kiowa knew that the successful management of this relationship could lay a permanent foundation for his venture. Ashley was a prominent man in St. Louis business and politics, a man with both the vision to bring commerce to the West and the money to make it happen. Other people's money, as Ashley had called it. Skittish money, nervous money, money that would flee easily from one speculative venture to the next. Kiowa squinted behind his thick spectacles, and though his vision was not sharp, he had a keen eye for reading people.
"If you will indulge me, Monsieur Ashley, perhaps I can offer one consolation while we await my boat."
Ashley offered no affirmative acknowledgement, but neither did he renew his tirade.
"I need to requisition more provisions from St. Louis," said Kiowa. "I'll send a courier downstream tomorrow by canoe. He can carry a dispatch from you to your syndicate. You can reassure them before rumors about Colonel Leavenworth's debacle take root."
Ashley sighed deeply and took a long sip of the sour ale. Resigned, through lack of alternative, to endure this latest delay. Like it or not, the Frenchman's advice was sound. He needed to reassure his investors before news of the battle ran unchecked through the streets of St. Louis. Kiowa sensed his opening and moved quickly to keep Ashley on a productive course. The Frenchman produced a quill, ink, and parchment, arranging them in front of Ashley and refilling the tin cup with ale.
"I leave you to your work, monsieur,"
he said, happy for the opportunity to retreat. By the dim light of a tallow candle, Ashley wrote deep into the night. "Fort Brazeau, on the Missouri, August 21st, 1823. James D. Pickens, Esquire, Pickens and Sons, St. Louis. Dear Mr. Pickens, it is my unfortunate responsibility to inform you of the events of the past 2 weeks. By their nature, these events must alter, though not deter, our venture on the Upper Missouri. As you probably know by now, the men of the Rocky Mountain Fur Company were attacked by the Arikara after trading in good faith for 60 horses. The Arikara attacked without provocation, killing 16 of our men, wounding a dozen, and stealing back the horses they had feigned to sell us the day before. In the face of this attack, I was forced to retreat downstream, while at the same time requesting the aid of Colonel Leavenworth and the U.S. Army in responding to this clear affront to the sovereign right of U.S. citizens to traverse the Missouri unimpeded. I also requested the support of our own men, who joined me, led by Captain Andrew Henry, at great peril from their position at Fort Union. By August 9th, we confronted the Arikara with a combined force of 700 men, including 200 of Leavenworth's regulars, with two howitzers, and 40 men of the RMF Company. We also found allies, albeit temporary, in 400 Sioux warriors, whose enmity for the Arikara stems from historical grudge, the origin of which I do not know. Suffice it to say that our assembled forces were more than ample to carry the field, punish the Arikara for their treachery, and reopen the Missouri for our venture. That such results did not occur, we owe to the unsteady timber of Colonel Leavenworth. The details of the inglorious encounter can await my return to St. Louis, but suffice it to say that the Colonel's repeated reluctance to engage in an inferior foe allowed the entire Arikara tribe to slip our grasp, the result being the effective closure of the Missouri between Fort Brazeau and the Mandan villages. Somewhere between here and there are 900 Arikara warriors, newly entrenched, no doubt, and with new motive to foil all attempts up the Missouri. Colonel Leavenworth has returned to garrison at Fort Atkinson, where he no doubt will pass the winter in front of a warm hearth, carefully mulling his options. I do not intend to wait for him. Our venture, as you know, can ill afford the loss of 8 months. Ashley stopped to read his text, unhappy with its dour tone. The letter reflected his anger, but did not convey his predominant emotion, a bedrock optimism, an unwavering faith in his own ability to succeed. God had placed him in a garden of infinite bounty, a land of Goshen, in which any man could prosper if only he had the courage and the fortitude to try. Ashley's weaknesses, which he confessed forthrightly, were simply barriers to be overcome by some creative combination of his strengths. Ashley expected setbacks, but he would not tolerate failure. We must turn this misfortune to our benefit, press on while our competitors take pause. With the Missouri effectively closed, I have decided to send two groups west by alternate route. Captain Henry, I have already dispatched up the Grand River. He will ascend the Grand as far as possible and make his way back to Fort Union. Jedediah Smith will lead a second troop up the Platte, his target the waters of the Great Basin. You no doubt share my intense frustration at our delay. We must now move boldly to recapture lost time. I have instructed Henry and Smith that they shall not return to St. Louis with their harvest in the spring. Rather, we shall go to them, rendezvous in the field to exchange their furs for fresh supplies. We can save 4 months this way and repay at least some portion of our debt to the clock. Meanwhile, I propose a new fur troop be raised in St. Louis and dispatched in the spring, led by me, personally. The remnants of the candle sputtered and spit foul black smoke. Ashley looked up, suddenly aware of the hour, of his deep fatigue. He dipped the quill and returned to his correspondence, writing firmly and quickly now as he drew his report to its conclusion. I urge you to communicate to our syndicate, in strongest possible terms, my complete confidence in the inevitable success of our endeavor. A great bounty has been laid by Providence before us, and we must not fail to summon the courage to claim our rightful share. Your very humble servant, William H. Ashley. 2 days later, August 16th, 1823, Kiowa Brazos' keelboat arrived from St. Louis. William Ashley provisioned his men and sent them west on the same day. The first rendezvous was set for the summer of 1824, the location to be communicated through couriers. Without understanding fully the significance of his decisions, William H. Ashley had invented the system that would define the era. 2. August 23rd, 1823. 11 men hunkered in the camp with no fire. The camp took advantage of a slight embankment on the Grand River, but the plain afforded little contour to conceal their position. A fire would have signaled their presence for miles, and stealth was the trapper's best ally against another attack. Most of the men used the last hour of daylight to clean rifles, repair moccasins, or eat. The boy had been asleep from the moment they stopped, a crumpled tangle of long limbs and ill-shod clothing. The men fell into clusters of three or four, huddled against the bank or pressed against a rock or a clump of sage, as if these minor protrusions might offer protection. The usual banter of camp had been dampened by the calamity on the Missouri, and then extinguished altogether by the second attack only 3 nights before. When they spoke at all, they spoke in hushed and pensive tones, respectful of the comrades who lay dead in their trail, heedful of the dangers still before them.
"Do you think he suffered, Hugh? I can't get it out of my head that he was suffering away all that time."
Hugh Glass looked up at the man, William Anderson, who had posed the question. Glass thought for a while before he answered.
"I don't think your brother suffered.
He was the oldest. When we left Kentucky, our folks told him to look after me. Didn't say a word to me. Wouldn't have occurred to them."
"You did your best for your brother, Will. It's a hard truth. But he was dead when that ball hit him 3 days ago."
A new voice spoke from the shadows near the bank.
"Wish we'd have buried him then instead of dragging him for 2 days."
The speaker perched on his haunches, and in the growing darkness, his face showed little feature except a dark beard and a white scar. The scar started near the corner of his mouth and curved down and around like a fishhook. Its prominence was magnified by the fact that no hair grew on the tissue, cutting a permanent sneer through his beard. His right hand worked the stout blade of a skinning knife over a whetstone as he spoke, mixing his words with a slow, rasping scrape.
"Keep your mouth shut, Fitzgerald, or I swear on my brother's grave, I'll rip out your bloody tongue."
"Your brother's grave? Not much of a grave now, was it?"
The men within earshot paid sudden attention, surprised at this conduct, even from Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald felt the attention, and it encouraged him.
"More just a pile of rocks. You think he's still in there moldering away?"
Fitzgerald paused for a moment, so that the only sound was the scraping of the blade on the stone.
"I doubt it, speaking for myself."
Again, he waited, calibrating the effect of his words as he spoke them.
"Of course, could be the rocks kept the varmints off, but I think the coyotes are dragging little bits of him across."
Anderson lunged at Fitzgerald with both hands extended. Fitzgerald brought his leg up sharply as he rose to meet the attack, his shin catching Anderson full force in the groin. The kick folded Anderson in two as if some hidden cord drew his neck to his knees. Fitzgerald drove his knee into the helpless man's face, and Anderson flipped backward. Fitzgerald moved spryly for someone his size, pouncing to pin his knee against the chest of the gasping, bleeding man. He put the skinning knife to Anderson's throat.
"You want to join your brother?"
Fitzgerald pressed the knife so that the blade drew a thin line of blood.
"Fitzgerald," Glass said,
in an even but authoritative tone. That's enough. Fitzgerald looked up. He contemplated an answer to Glass's challenge, while noting with satisfaction the ring of men that now surrounded him, witnesses to Anderson's pathetic position. Better to claim victory, he decided. He'd see to Glass another day. Fitzgerald removed the blade from Anderson's throat and rammed the knife into the beaded sheath on his belt.
Don't start things you can't finish, Anderson. Next time I'll finish it for you.
Captain Andrew Henry pushed his way through the circle of spectators. He grabbed Fitzgerald from behind and ripped him backward, pushing him hard into the embankment. One more fight and you're out, Fitzgerald. Henry pointed beyond the perimeter of the camp to the distant horizon. If you've got an extra store of piss, you can try making it on your own. The captain looked around him at the rest of the men. We'll cover 40 miles tomorrow. You're wasting time if you're not asleep already. Now, who's taking first watch? No one stepped forward. Henry's eyes came to rest on the boy, oblivious to the commotion. Henry took a handful of determined steps to the crumpled form. Get up, Bridger! The boy sprang up, wide-eyed, as he grasped, bewildered, for his gun. The rusted trading musket had been an advance on his salary, along with a yellowed powder horn and a handful of flints. I want you 100 yards downstream. Find a high spot along the bank. Pig, the same thing upstream. Fitzgerald, Anderson, you'll take second watch. Fitzgerald had stood watch the night before. For a moment, it appeared he would protest the distribution of labor. He thought better of it, sulking instead to the edge of the camp. The boy, still disoriented, half stumbled across the rocks that spilled along the river's edge, disappearing into the cobalt blackness that encroached on the brigade. The man they called Pig was born Phineas Gilmore on a dirt-poor farm in Kentucky. No mystery surrounded his nickname. He was enormous, and he was filthy. Pig smelled so bad, it confused people. When they encountered his reek, they looked around him for the source, so implausible did it seem that the odor could emanate from a human. Even the trappers, who placed no particular premium on cleanliness, did their best to keep Pig downwind. After hoisting himself slowly to his feet, Pig slung his rifle over his shoulder and ambled upstream. Less than an hour passed before the daylight receded completely. Glass watched as Captain Henry returned from a nervous check of the sentries. He picked his way by moonlight among the sleeping men, and Glass realized that he and Henry were the only men awake. The captain chose the ground next to Glass, leaning against his rifle as he eased his large frame to the ground. Repose took the weight off his tired feet, but failed to relieve the pressure he felt most heavily. I want you and Black Harris to scout tomorrow, said Captain Henry. Glass looked up, disappointed that he could not respond to the beckoning call of sleep. Find something to shoot in late afternoon. We'll risk a fire. Henry lowered his voice as if making a confession. We're way behind, Hugh. Henry gave every indication that he intended to talk for a while. Glass reached for his rifle. If he couldn't sleep, he might as well tend his weapon. He had doused it in a river crossing that afternoon and wanted to apply fresh grease to the trigger works. Cold'll set in hard by early December, continued the captain. We'll need 2 weeks to lay in a supply of meat. If we're not on the Yellowstone before October, we'll have no fall hunt. If Captain Henry was racked by internal doubt, his commanding physical presence betrayed no infirmity. The band of leather fringe on his deerskin tunic cut a swath across his broad shoulders and chest, remnants of his former profession as a lead miner in the Saint-Genevieve district of Missouri. He was narrow at the waist, where a thick leather belt held a brace of pistols and a large knife. His breeches were doe-skin to the knee, and from there down, red wool. The captain's pants had been specially tailored in St. Louis, and were a badge of his wilderness experience. Leather provided excellent protection, but wading made it heavy and cold. Wool, by contrast, dried quickly and retained heat even when wet. If the brigade he led was motley, Henry at least drew satisfaction from the fact they called him captain. In truth, of course, Henry knew the title was an artifice. His band of trappers had nothing to do with the military and scant respect for any institution. Still, Henry was the only man among them to have trod and trapped the Three Forks. If title meant little, experience was the coin of the realm. The captain paused, waiting for acknowledgement from Glass. Glass looked up from his rifle. It was a brief look, because he had unscrewed the elegantly scrolled guard that covered the rifle's twin triggers. He cupped the two screws carefully in his hand, afraid of dropping them in the dark. The glance sufficed, enough to encourage Henry to continue. "Did I ever tell you about Captain Drouillard?"
"No, Captain."
"You know who he was?"
"George Drouillard, Corps of Discovery?"
Henry nodded his head. "Lewis and Clark, man, one of their best. A scout and a hunter. In 1809, he signed up with the group I led. He led, really, to the Three Forks. We had 100 men, but Drouillard and Coulter was the only ones who'd ever been there. We found beaver thick as mosquitoes. Barely had to trap them. Could go out with a club. But we ran into trouble with the Blackfeet from the start. 5 men killed before 2 weeks was up. We had to ford up. Couldn't send out trapping parties. Drouillard holed up there with the rest of us for about a week before he said he was tired of sitting still. He went out the next day and came back a week later with 20 plus. Glass paid the captain his full attention. Every citizen of St. Louis knew some version of Drouillard's story, but Glass had never heard a first-person account. He did that twice, went out and came back with a pack of plus. Last thing he said before he left the third time was, "Third time's charmed." He rode off, and we heard 2 gunshots about half an hour later, one from his rifle and one from his pistol. Second shot must have been him shooting his horse, trying to make a barrier. That's where we found him, behind his horse. There must have been 20 arrows between him and the horse. Blackfeet left the arrows in, wanted to send us a message. They hacked him up, too. Cut off his head. The captain paused again, scraping at the dirt in front of him with a pointed stick. "I keep thinking about him." Glass searched for words of reassurance. Before he could say anything, the captain asked, "How long do you figure this river's going to keep running west?" Glass stared intently now, searching for the captain's eyes.
"We'll start making better time, Captain. We can follow the Grand for the time being. We know the Yellowstone's north and west.
In truth, Glass had developed significant doubts about the captain. Misfortune seemed to hang on him like day before smoke.
"You're right," the captain said.
And then he said it again as if to convince himself. "Of course you're right." Though his knowledge was born of calamity, Captain Henry knew as much about the geography of the Rockies as almost any man alive. Glass, though an experienced plainsman, had never set foot on the upper Missouri. Yet Henry found something steady and reassuring in Glass's voice. Someone had told him that Glass had been a mariner in his youth. There was even a rumor that he'd been a prisoner of the pirate Jean Lafitte. Perhaps it was those years on the empty expanse of the high seas that left him comfortable on the featureless plains between St. Louis and the Rocky Mountains. "We'll be lucky if the Blackfeet haven't wiped out the whole lot at Fort Union. The men I left there aren't exactly the cream of the crop." The captain continued now with his usual catalogue of concerns. On and on into the night. Glass knew that it was enough just to listen. He looked up or grunted from time to time, but focused, in the main, on his rifle. Glass's rifle was the one extravagance of his life, and when he rubbed grease into the spring mechanism of the hair trigger, he did so with the tender affection that other men might reserve for a wife or child. It was an Anstatt, a so-called Kentucky flintlock, made, like most of the great arms of the day, by German craftsmen in Pennsylvania. The octagonal barrel was inscribed at the base with the name of its maker, Jakob Anstatt, and the place of its manufacture, Kutztown, Penn. The barrel was short, only 36 inches. The classic Kentucky rifles were longer, some with barrels stretching 50 inches. Glass liked a shorter gun because shorter meant lighter, and lighter meant easier to carry. For those rare moments when he might be mounted, a shorter gun was easier to maneuver from the back of a horse. Besides, the expertly crafted rifling of the Anstatt made it deadly accurate, even without the longer barrel. A hair trigger enhanced its accuracy, allowing discharge with the lightest touch. With a full charge of 200 grains of black powder, the Anstatt could throw a .53 caliber ball nearly 200 yards. His experiences on the Western Plains had taught Glass that the performance of his rifle could mean the difference between life and death. Of course, most men in the troop had reliable weapons. It was the Anstatt's elegant beauty that set his gun apart. It was a beauty that other men noticed, asking, as they often did, if they might hold the rifle. The iron-hard walnut of the stock took an elegant curve at the wrist, but was thick enough to absorb the recoil of a heavy powder charge. The butt featured a patch box on one side and a carved cheek piece on the other. The stock turned gracefully at the butt so that it fit against the shoulder like an appendage of the shooter's own body. The stock was stained the deepest of browns, the last tone before black. From even a short distance, the grain of the wood was imperceptible, but on close examination, irregular lines seemed to swirl, animated beneath the hand-rubbed coats of varnish. In a final indulgence, the metal fittings of the rifle were silver instead of the usual brass, adorning the gun at the butt plate, the patch box, the trigger guard, the triggers themselves, and the cupped fittings on the ends of the ram staff. Many trappers pounded brass studs into their rifle stocks for decoration. Glass could not imagine such a gaudy disfigurement of his Anstatt. Satisfied that his rifle's works were clear, Glass returned the trigger guard to its routed groove and replaced the two screws that held it. He poured fresh powder in the pan beneath the flint, ensuring that the gun was primed to fire. He noticed suddenly that the camp had fallen still, and wondered vaguely when the captain had stopped talking. Glass looked toward the center of the camp. The captain lay sleeping, his body twitching fitfully. On the other side of Glass, closest to the camp's perimeter, Anderson lay against a chunk of driftwood. No sound rose above the reassuring flow of the river. The sharp crack of a flintlock pierced the quiet. It came from downstream, from Jim Bridger, the boy. The sleeping men lurched in unison, fearful and confused as they scrambled for weapons and cover. A dark form hurtled toward the camp from downstream. Next to Glass, Anderson cocked and raised his rifle in a single motion. Glass raised the Anstatt. The hurtling form took shape only 40 yards from the camp. Anderson sighted down the barrel, hesitating an instant before pulling the trigger. At the same instant, Glass swung the Anstatt beneath Anderson's arms. The force knocked Anderson's barrel skyward as his powder ignited. The hurtling form stopped cold at the explosion of the shot, the distance now close enough to perceive the wide eyes and heaving chest. It was Bridger. A panicked stammer paralyzed him. "What happened, Bridger?" demanded the captain, peering beyond the boy into the darkness downstream. The trappers had fallen into a defensive semicircle with the embankment behind them. Most had assumed a firing position, perched on one knee, rifles at full cock.
"I'm sorry, Captain. I didn't mean to fire. I heard a sound, a crash in the brush. I stood up and I guess the hammer slipped. It just went off."
"More likely you fell asleep."
Fitzgerald uncocked his rifle and rose from his knee.
"Every buck for 5 miles is headed our way now."
Bridger started to speak, but searched in vain for the words to express the depth of his shame and regret. He stood there, open-mouthed, staring in horror at the men arrayed before him. Glass stepped forward, pulling Bridger's smoothbore from his hands. He cocked the musket and pulled the trigger, catching the hammer with his thumb before the flint struck the frisson. He repeated the action.
"This is a poor excuse for a weapon, Captain. Give him a decent rifle and we'll have fewer problems on watch."
A few of the men nodded their heads. The captain looked first at Glass, then at Bridger, and he said,
"Anderson, Fitzgerald, it's your watch."
The two men took their positions, one upstream and one down. The sentries were redundant. No one slept in the few hours remaining before dawn. 3. August 24th, 1823. Hugh Glass stared down at the cloven tracks, the deep indentations clear as newsprint in the soft mud. Two distinct sets began at the river's edge, where the deer must have drunk, and then trailed into the heavy cover of the willows. The persistent work of a beaver had carved a trail now trod by a variety of game. Dung lay piled next to the tracks, and Glass stooped to touch the pea-sized pellets. Still warm. Glass looked west, where the sun still perched high above the plateau that formed the distant horizon. He guessed there were 3 hours before sunset. Still early, but it would take the captain and the rest of the men an hour to catch up. Besides, it was an ideal campsite. The river folded gently against a long bar and gravel bank. Beyond the willows, a stand of cottonwoods offered cover for their campfires and a supply of firewood. The willows were ideal for smoke racks. Glass noticed plum trees scattered among the willows, a lucky break. They could grind pemmican from the combined fruit and meat. He looked downriver.
Where's Black Harris?
In the hierarchy of challenges the trappers faced each day, obtaining food was the most immediate. Like other challenges, it involved a complicated balancing of benefits and risks. They carried virtually no food with them, especially since abandoning the flatboats on the Missouri and proceeding on foot up the Grand. A few men still had tea or sugar, but most were down to a bag of salt for preserving meat. Game was plentiful on this stretch of the Grand, and they could have dined on fresh meat each night, but harvesting game meant shooting, and the sound of a rifle carried from miles, revealing their position to any foe within earshot. Since leaving the Missouri, the men had held closely to a pattern. Each day, two scouted ahead of the others. For the time being, their path was fixed. They simply followed the Grand. The scouts' primary responsibilities were to avoid Indians, select a campsite, and find food. They shot fresh game every few days. After shooting a deer or buffalo calf, the scouts prepared the camp for the evening. They bled the game, gathered wood, and set two or three small fires in narrow rectangular pits. Smaller fires produced less smoke than a single conflagration, while also offering more surface for smoking meat and more sources of heat. If enemies did spot them at night, more fires gave the illusion of more men. Once flames were burning, the scouts butchered their game, pulling choice cuts for immediate consumption and cutting thin strips with the rest. They constructed crude racks with green willow branches, rubbed the meat strips with a little salt, and hung them just above the flames. It wasn't the type of jerky they would make in a permanent camp, which would keep for months, but the meat would keep for several days, enough to last until the next fresh game. Glass stepped from the willows into a clearing. Scanning for the deer, he knew must be just ahead. He saw the cubs before he saw the sow. There was a pair, and they tumbled toward him, bawling like playful dogs. The cubs had been dropped in the spring, and at 5 months weighed 100 pounds each. They nipped at each other as they bore down on Glass. And for the briefest of instants, the scene had a near comic quality. Transfixed by the whirling motion of the cubs, Glass had not raised his glance to the far end of the clearing, 50 yards away. Nor had he yet to calculate the certain implication of their presence. Suddenly he knew. A hollowness seized his stomach half an instant before the first rumbling growl crossed the clearing. The cubs skidded to an immediate stop, not 10 feet in front of Glass. Ignoring the cubs now, Glass peered toward the brush line across the clearing. He heard her sighs before he saw it, not just the crack of the thick underbrush that the sow moved aside like short grass, but the growl itself, a sound deep like thunder or a falling tree, a bass that could emanate only through connection with some great mass. The growl crescendoed as she stepped into the clearing, black eyes staring at Glass, head low to the ground as she processed the foreign scent, a scent now mingling with that of her cubs. She faced him head on, her body coiled and taut like the heavy spring on a buckboard. Glass marveled at the animal's utter muscularity, the thick stumps of her forelegs folding into massive shoulders, and above all, the silvery hump that identified her as a grizzly. Glass struggled to control his reaction as he processed his options. His reflex, of course, screamed at him to flee. Back through the willows, into the river, perhaps he could dive low and escape downstream. But the bear was already too close for that, barely 100 feet in front of him. His eyes searched desperately for a cottonwood to climb. Perhaps he could scramble out of reach, then shoot from above. No, the trees were behind the bear. Nor did the willows provide sufficient cover. His options dwindled to one. Stand and shoot. One chance to stop the grizzly with a .53 caliber ball from the Anstalt. The grizzly charged, roaring with the focused hate of protective maternal rage. Reflex again nearly compelled Glass to turn and run, yet the futility of flight was instantly apparent, as the grizzly closed the ground between them with remarkable speed. Glass pulled the hammer to full cock and raised the Anstalt, staring through the pronghorn sight in stunned horror that the animal could be, at the same time, enormous and lithe. He fought another instinct, to shoot immediately. Glass had seen grizzlies absorb 6 rifle balls without dying. He had one shot. Glass struggled to sight on the bouncing target of the sow's head, unable to align a shot. At 10 paces, the grizzly lifted herself to a standing position. She towered 3 feet over Glass as she pivoted for the raking swipe of her lethal claws. Point blank, he aimed at the great bear's heart and pulled the trigger. The flint sparked, the Anstalt's pan setting off the rifle and filling the air with the smoke and smell of exploding black powder. The grizzly roared as the ball entered her chest, but her attack did not slow. Glass dropped his rifle, useless now, and reached for the knife in the scabbard on his belt. The bear brought down her paw, and Glass felt the sickening sensation of the animal's 6-inch claws dredging deep into the flesh of his upper arm, shoulder, and throat. The blow threw him to his back, the knife dropped, and he pushed furiously against the earth with his feet, futilely seeking the cover of the willows. The grizzly dropped to all fours and was on him. Glass rolled into a ball, desperate to protect his face and chest. She bit into the back of his neck and lifted him off the ground, shaking him so hard that Glass wondered if his spine might snap. He felt the crunch of her teeth striking the bone of his shoulder blade. Claws raked repeatedly through the flesh of his back and scalp. He screamed in agony. She dropped him, then sank her teeth deep into his thigh and shook him again, lifting him and throwing him to the ground with such force that he lay stunned, conscious, but unable to resist any further. He lay on his back, staring up. The grizzly stood before him on her hind legs. Terror and pain receded, replaced by a horrified fascination at the towering animal. She let out a final roar, which registered in Glass's mind like an echo across a great distance. He was aware of enormous weight on top of him. The dank smell of her coat overwhelmed his other senses. What was it? His mind searched and then locked on the image of a yellow dog licking a boy's face on the plank porch of a cabin. The sunlit sky above him faded to black. Black Harris heard the shot just ahead around a bend in the river and hoped that Glass had shot a deer. He moved forward quickly but quietly, aware that a rifle shot could mean many things. Harris began to trot when he heard the roar of the bear. Then he heard Glass scream. At the willows, Harris found the tracks of both the deer and Glass. He peered into the path cut by a beaver, listening intently. No sound rose above the hushed trickle of the river. Harris pointed the rifle from his hip, his thumb on the hammer and his forefinger near the trigger. He glanced briefly at the pistol on his belt, assuring himself that it was primed. He stepped into the willows, carefully placing each moccasin as he peered ahead. The bawling of the cubs broke the silence. At the edge of the clearing, Black Harris stopped to absorb the scene before him. An enormous grizzly lay sprawled on her belly, eyes open but dead. One cub stood on hind legs, pressing against the sow with its nose, futilely seeking to evoke some sign of life. The other cub rooted at something, tugging with his teeth. Harris realized suddenly it was a man's arm. Glass. He raised his rifle and shot the nearer of the two cubs. It fell limp. The sibling scampered for the cottonwoods and disappeared. Harris reloaded before walking forward. Captain Henry and the men of the brigade heard the two shots and hurried upstream. The first shot didn't worry the captain, but the second one did. The first shot was expected, Glass or Harris bringing down game, as they had planned the night before. Two shots closely spaced also would be normal. Two men hunting together might come upon more than one target, or the first shooter might miss. But several minutes separated the two shots. The captain hoped that the hunters were working apart. Perhaps the first shooter had flushed game to the second, or perhaps they had been lucky enough to come across buffalo. Buffalo would sometimes stand, unfazed by the clap of a rifle, allowing a hunter to reload and casually pick a second target. "Keep tight, men, and check your arms." For the third time in 100 paces, Bridger checked the new rifle that Will Anderson had given to him. "My brother don't need this no more," was all he said. In the clearing, Black Harris looked down at the body of the bear. Only Glass's arm protruded from underneath. Harris glanced around before setting his rifle on the ground, tugging at the bear's foreleg in an attempt to move the carcass. Heaving, he pulled the animal far enough to see Glass's head, a bloody tangle of hair and flesh. Jesus Christ. He worked urgently, fighting against the fear of what he would find. Harris moved to the opposite side of the bear, climbing across the animal to grab its foreleg, then tugging, his knees pressed against the grizzly's body for leverage. After several attempts, he managed to roll the front half of the bear so that the giant animal lay twisted at the midsection. Then he pulled several times at the rear leg. He gave a final heave, and the bear tumbled heavily onto her back. Glass's body was free. On the sow's chest, Black Harris noticed the matted blood where Glass's shot had found its mark. Black Harris knelt next to Glass, unsure of what to do. It was not through lack of experience with the wounded. He had removed arrows and bullets from 3 men, and twice had been shot himself. But he had never seen human carnage like this, fresh in the wake of attack. Glass was shredded. From head to foot, his scalp lay dangling to one side, and it took Harris an instant to recognize the components that made up his face. Worst was his throat. The grizzly's claws had cut three deep and distinct tracks, beginning at the shoulder and passing straight across his neck. Another inch, and the claws would have severed Glass's jugular. As it was, they had laid open his throat, slicing through muscle and exposing his gullet. The claws had also cut the trachea, and Harris watched, horrified, as a large bubble formed in the blood that seeped from the wound. It was the first clear sign that Glass was alive. Harris rolled Glass gently on his side to inspect his back. Nothing remained of his cotton shirt. Blood oozed from deep puncture wounds at his neck and shoulder. His right arm flopped unnaturally. From the middle of his back to his waist, the bear's raking claws left deep, parallel cuts. It reminded Harris of tree trunks he had seen, where bears marked their territory. Only these marks were etched in flesh instead of wood. On the back of Glass's thigh, blood seeped through his buckskin breeches. Harris had no idea where to begin, and was almost relieved that the throat wound appeared so obviously mortal. He pulled Glass a few yards to a grassy, shaded spot and eased him to his back. Ignoring the bubbling throat, Harris focused on the head. Glass at least deserved the dignity of wearing his scalp. Harris poured water from his canteen, attempting to wash away as much of the dirt as possible. The skin was so loose that it was almost like replacing a fallen hat on a bald man. Harris pulled the scalp across Glass's skull, pressing the loose skin against his forehead and tucking it behind his ear. They could stitch it later, if Glass lasted that long. Harris heard a sound in the brush and drew his pistol. Captain Henry stepped into the clearing. The men filed grimly behind, eyes moving from Glass to the sow, from Harris to the dead cub. The captain surveyed the clearing, oddly numb as his mind filtered the scene through the context of his own past. He shook his head, and for a moment his eyes, normally sharp, seemed not to focus. Is he dead?
Not yet, but he's torn to pieces, his windpipe's cut.
Did he kill the sow?
Harris nodded.
I found her dead on top of him. There's a ball in her heart. Not soon enough, eh?
It was Fitzgerald.
The captain knelt next to Glass. With grimy fingers, he poked at the throat wound, where bubbles continued to form with each breath. The breathing had grown more labored, and a tepid wheeze now rose and fell with Glass's chest.
Somebody get me a clean strip of cloth and some water. And whiskey, in case he wakes up.
Bridger stepped forward, rummaging through a small satchel from his back. He pulled a wool shirt from the bag and handed it to Henry. Here, Captain. The captain paused, hesitant to take the boy's shirt. Then he grabbed it, tearing strips from the coarse cloth. He poured the contents of his canteen on Glass's throat. Blood washed away, quickly replaced by the wound's heavy seep. Glass began to sputter and cough. His eyes fluttered, then opened wide, panicky. Glass's first sensation was that he was drowning. He coughed again as his body attempted to clear the blood from his throat and lungs. He focused briefly on Henry as the captain rolled him to his side. From his side, Glass was able to swallow two breaths before nausea overwhelmed him. He vomited, igniting excruciating pain in his throat. Instinctively, Glass reached to touch his neck. His right arm wouldn't function, but his left hand found the gaping wound. He was overcome with horror and panic at what his fingers discovered. His eyes became wild, searching for reassurance in the faces surrounding him. Instead, he saw the opposite. Awful affirmation of his fears. Glass tried to speak, but his throat could muster no sound beyond an eerie wail. He struggled to rise on his elbows. Henry pinned him to the ground, pouring whiskey on his throat. A searing burn replaced all other pain. Glass convulsed a final time before again losing consciousness.
We need to mind his wounds while he's down. Cut more strips, Bridger.
The boy began ripping long lengths from the shirt. The other men watched solemnly, standing like casket bearers at a funeral. The captain looked up.
Rest of you get moving. Harris, scout a wide circle around us. Make sure those shots didn't draw attention our way. Someone get the fires going. Make sure the wood's dry. We don't need a damn smoke signal. And get that sow butchered.
The men moved off, and the captain turned again to Glass. He took a strip of cloth from Bridger and threaded it behind Glass's neck, tying it as tightly as he dared. He repeated the action with two more strips. Blood soaked the cloth instantly. He wound another strip around Glass's head in a crude effort to hold his scalp in place. The head wounds also bled heavily, and the captain used water and the shirt to mop the blood pooling around Glass's eyes. He sent Bridger to refill the canteen from the river. When Bridger returned, they again rolled Glass onto his side. Bridger held him, keeping his face from the ground, while Captain Henry inspected his back. Henry poured water on the puncture wounds from the bear's fangs. Though deep, they bled very little. The five parallel wounds from the bear's claws were a different story. Two in particular cut deep into Glass's back, exposing the muscle and bleeding heavily. Dirt mixed freely with the blood, and the captain again dumped water from the canteen. Without the dirt, the wounds seemed to bleed even more, so the captain left them alone. He cut two long strips from the shirt, worked them around Glass's body, and tied them tightly. It didn't work. The strips did little to stop his back from bleeding. The captain paused to think.
These deep wounds need to be stitched, or he'll bleed to death.
What about his throat?
How to sew that up, too, but it's such a damn mess, I don't know where to start.
Henry dug into his possibles bag and pulled out coarse black thread and a heavy needle. The captain's thick fingers were surprisingly nimble as he threaded the needle and tied an end knot. Bridger held the edges of the deepest wound together and watched, wide-eyed, as Henry pressed the needle into Glass's skin. He worked the needle from side to side, four stitches pulling the skin together in the center of the cut. He tied off the ends of the thick thread. Of the five claw wounds on Glass's back, two were deep enough to need stitches. For each wound, the captain made no effort to sew the entire length. Instead, he simply bound the middle together. But the bleeding slowed.
Now let's look at his neck.
They rolled Glass onto his back. Despite the crude bandages, the throat continued to bubble and wheeze. Beneath the open skin, Henry could see the bright white cartilage of the gullet and windpipe. He knew from the bubbles that the windpipe was cut or nicked, but he had no idea how to repair it. He held his hand over Glass's mouth, feeling for breath.
What are you going to do, Captain?
The captain tied a new end knot in the thread on the needle.
He's still getting some air through his mouth. Best we can do is close up the skin. Hope for the rest he can heal himself.
At inch-wide intervals, Henry sewed stitches to close Glass's throat. Bridger cleared a piece of ground in the shade of the willows and arranged Glass's bedroll. They laid him there as gently as they could. The captain took his rifle and walked away from the clearing, back through the willows toward the river. When he reached the water, he set his rifle on the bank and removed his leather tunic. His hands were coated in sticky blood, and he reached into the stream to wash them. When some spots would not come clean, he scooped sand from the bank and scrubbed it against the stains. Finally, he gave up, cupping his hands and pressing the icy stream water to his bearded face. Familiar doubt crept back. It's happening again. It was no surprise when the green succumbed to the wilderness. But it came as a shock when the veterans fell victim. Like Driard, Glass had spent years on the frontier. He was a keel, steadying others through his quiet presence. And Henry knew that by morning, he would be dead. The captain thought back to his conversation with Glass the night